The weather across England and Wales shouldn't be too bad at all, apart from one or two showers, maybe in the northwest of England, perhaps one or two in the Midlands. Temperatures will reach around 8 or 9 degrees. And then the outlook for the weekend, Saturday's the bright day, Sunday it'll turn cloudy again. Steve, back to you.
Thomas, thanks very much. Now on BBC Radio 4, Henry Goodman continues our Book of the Week. On the 1st of January 1984, François Mitterrand took over the rotating presidency of the EEC. During his term of office, he hoped to engineer a balance between Britain and West Germany, which would allow France to advance its agenda by playing off one against the other.
Mitterrand went out of his way to cultivate Margaret Thatcher. In his first months in office, to the dismay of the French left, he remained silent about the deaths of 10 Irish Republican hunger strikers. The following year, France was the first Western country to declare unconditional support for Britain in the Falklands conflict. Unlike the Reagan administration, which, mindful of its ties with the military dictatorships in Latin America, tried unsuccessfully to broker a compromise with Argentina before, reluctantly, agreeing to back the British position. The morning after the invasion, Mitterrand telephoned Thatcher to assure her of his support. His call was totally unexpected. She said later, "I shall never forget that quick, timely, and energetic gesture." Like other EEC nations, France refused to break diplomatic relations with Buenos Aires or to take a position on the island's sovereignty, but short of that, the French president did everything in his power to help. At Thatcher's request, he delayed a shipment of Exocet air-to-sea missiles to Peru, lest they find their way to the Argentinians. And, after an Exocet had disabled HMS Sheffield, he ordered that the British be given details of the missile's radar guidance codes. At a personal level, Mitterrand and Thatcher were an odd couple. She was single-minded and obdurate, with no place in her vocabulary for ambiguity or compromise. He was the opposite. Yet they managed to strike up a rapport. Mitterrand's closest aide, Jacques Attali, thought it was because he was intrigued by her as a woman. His deputy chief of staff, Anne Lauvergeon, offered a different perspective. He was one of the few in Europe who treated her as an equal. She appreciated that. Thatcher spoke better French than Mitterrand spoke English, and with a strong accent which enchanted him. "If you close your eyes, you could think she's Jane Birkin." On the way back from one visit to London, he mused, "She has the eyes of Caligula and the mouth of Marilyn Monroe." From the outset, Thatcher made clear that there were two major problems she wanted resolved. The first was to put a cap on the common agricultural policy, which guaranteed farmers minimum prices for their produce and absorbed 75% of the EEC budget. It mainly benefited France, while Britain got little back because it had too few farmers to profit from it. Moreover, the guarantees were leading to massive overproduction. "It's not rational," she told Mitterrand, "to spend a growing part of the community budget on surpluses that cost more and more." The second problem, she argued, was that Britain, as a net contributor, was paying more than its fair share. To correct that, she wanted a permanent rebate. The issue wasn't new, nor was it as simple as she made out. For historical reasons, much of Britain's trade was outside Europe. So the income from custom duties which it levied on non-EEC goods and then forwarded to Brussels was larger than that from other member countries. Thatcher insisted that these payments were part of Britain's contribution, though none of the other member states counted them that way. In 1980, the year after her election, she'd obtained a provisional 2-year rebate, which had subsequently been extended, amounting to almost 2/3 of the British payment. But a permanent settlement had eluded her. To Mitterrand's dismay, When he received her in Paris in January 84, she insisted on reopening the negotiations from scratch. The reason soon became clear. In 1983, she'd accepted a much lower payment, 750 million euros, compared to the 1.175 billion that she'd had in 1980. But the difference had been more than made up for by overpayments from Brussels during the previous 3 years, which she now refused to return. At the next EEC summit, held under Mitterrand's chairmanship in March, Britain was offered a rebate of 1 billion euros a year, guaranteed for 5 years. Thatcher refused. Would she accept, she was asked, if the figure was raised to 1.1 billion? Again, she refused. The minimum she'd accept was 1.3 billion. It was one refusal too many. Britain's partners lost patience. This was the period, one official recalled, when
the only time she said a yes was when she was asked, "Are you against it?"
4 years later, even the comradeship between Thatcher and her fellow right-winger Jacques Chirac, then French Prime Minister, frayed to the point where, after a particularly long day of British obstruction, the French leader exploded.
"Bollocks! Whenever you start speaking, you get angry and you lay down the law. How do you expect anyone to ask your opinion after that?"
But at Fontainebleau in 1984, that was all still in the future. Mitterrand's problem then was to find a way to deal with Thatcher. His answer was an alliance with the West German Chancellor, Helmut Kohl.
"Thatcher understands that she'll have to give way, but she doesn't want to admit it,"
Kohl told Mitterrand that spring.
"She's talked too much about it in Parliament. She's terribly afraid that if she accepts a lower figure, it will be seen as an admission that she got it wrong."
The French president agreed. "Maybe we have to find a way to dress it up, to create an appearance of success for her. But 1.1 billion is too much. The problem with her is that she always takes a compromise proposal as a new starting point. She thinks she's at Trafalgar. In March, she behaved like a child who wanted 2 spoonfuls of jam on her bread and was told she could not have them." Kohl sighed.
"What a waste of energy on this British problem. We have to find a way to prevent it continuing."
At the end of May, the ten reconvened in the former royal palace at Fontainebleau, where Napoleon had been forced to abdicate by a coalition of his European opponents. This time, Mitterrand felt the shoe was on the other foot. In great secrecy, the French and Germans had worked out a plan under which, if Thatcher continued to refuse a settlement, the other nine would continue to operate key EEC programs without her, which would mean that Britain was sidelined. Thatcher had stated publicly that she wanted a rebate of 1.2 billion that year and 1.25 billion the following year. Next morning, Mitterrand made his final offer, 1 billion euros for 2 years. After lunch, Thatcher had a private meeting with Kohl, who confirmed West Germany's support for the French position. Then Mitterrand also privately told her the offer was to take or to leave. Jacques Attali wrote afterwards, "She cracked, like glass, on the verge of tears. She just wanted to get it over with. An astonishing sight." At the plenary session that afternoon, she had to accept significantly less than she'd turned down in March. Mitterrand kept his word. The deal was dressed up as a British success, and the Iron Lady was able to return to London in triumph. Years later, a few months before his death, Mitterrand spoke of his relationship with "dear Mrs. Thatcher," as he called her.
Her inimitable mixture of firmness and tactical flexibility consisted of presenting her setbacks in a glorious light. She was an accomplished practitioner of this kind of alchemy, to which she gave herself every time she returned from a European summit, so that in her own country, her ideas, which were always rejected by her partners, won her, after a proud speech before the House of Commons, a Roman triumph.
The importance of Fontainebleau, however, lay elsewhere. After almost a decade in which the European community had marked time, haggling over milk quotas, the wine lake, the butter mountain, and fishing rights, the resolution of the dispute over the British rebate opened the way to progress on a host of other issues. It was the start of a period of political and economic change on a scale not seen in Europe since the end of the Second World War. The Fontainebleau summit succeeded because of the entente between Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl. Mitterrand had established his bona fides in the eyes of the West German Chancellor with a speech to the Bundestag 18 months before, backing Kohl's decision to install Euromissiles on German soil. But their understanding had begun earlier. 3 days after Kohl's election in October 1982, he'd flown to Paris to assure Mitterrand of the importance he attached to the Franco-German relationship. Part of their conversation had been about the war. Kohl had been 15 in 1945, Mitterrand 28. Both were from a generation whose commitment to Europe was founded on memories of carnage. At one point, Kohl had told him,
"I would like to talk to you very openly as a younger man to someone older whom he trusts. You are a man steeped in history and literature, and I am too, and I want to tell you something. My grandfather had a son who died in the War of 14. My father named his elder son after him, and that son died in turn in the war in 45. My own son has the same name as my dead brother, and he is now starting his military service. He knows very well the meaning of freedom. We want to meet the challenge, which consists of having both freedom and peace." It was a language Mitterrand understood, but until Fontainebleau, he'd worried that Kohl might switch his support to Britain, with which he had a common interest, because West Germany was also a net contributor to the community budget. But that had not happened. Helmut Kohl was a massive bear of a man, a bon vivant, bluff, hearty and expansive, with unusual political acumen. Mitterrand, introverted and ambivalent, wasn't an obvious soulmate, yet they found unexpected common interests, including the philosophy of religion. Jean-Paul Bianco, the Élysée Secretary General, remembered listening to them for hours, discussing the relationship between pietism and quietism. Both felt passionately about the future of Europe. For the next decade, they formed a political partnership closer and more enduring than that of Thatcher and Reagan. 3 months after Fontainebleau, in September, at Verdun, where 700,000 French and German soldiers had died in 1916, they created a poignant symbol of that shared desire for peace. Standing bareheaded at the ossuary at Douaumont, in the battlefield where Kohl's uncle had died in the First War and Mitterrand had been taken prisoner in the Second, they linked hands in the driving rain, while a military band played the German and French anthems.
Henry Goodman is reading Mitterrand by Philip Short. It's abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions for BBC Radio 4, and it continues tomorrow when Mitterrand leaves the Élysée Palace for the last time. Now, back over La Manche and around we go. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 29th of November. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Trafalgar, Irish Sea, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, high West Shannon 1039 moving away slowly westwards, low Iceland 1002 expected Kattegat 995 by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, southwest, veering northwest, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later, rain then squally showers, good occasionally poor. North Utsira, South Utsira, westerly becoming cyclonic for a time.